Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Ask Catherine and the Soleri team. We're recording on Wednesday, August 16th for publication on Friday, August 18th. Questions as of August 14th. If you didn't get your question in, it'll roll into the next Ask Catherine next week. And again, just to remind, we're going to be doing technology questions, a brief segment on the last week of the month. Normally, we haven't done one on the last week, but now this is the new and improved. So, Tech Corner last week. So, again, thank you for your questions organized by categories. Let's just dive into cash and precious metals. So, question number one, Texas bill announcement, SB 2334 by Hughes Finance. 4/27/2023. I guess Hughes must be the representative, Carolyn. Is that it?
Right. I'm assuming he's the finance committee.
Rules for securing digital currency, preventing fraud by establishing and administrating a digital gold currency. Catherine, is this something you would recommend? So here's the thing, a digital gold currency could be fine. It could be horribly well misused. So you could link, if it's a digital currency, it can get linked up and controlled. Just like a CBDC, just because it's got gold in it, it's the same problem. Any digital, even if they put chips in cash, any digital is going to have a control issue. Gold-backed CBDC administered via the controller with fees plus cash and coin, maybe. Then each unit of digital currency issued represents a particular fraction of troy ounce of gold held in trust. I have no comprehension of this previous statement. What is a particular fraction? I'm just saying it's a percentage of a troy ounce. So something can be a half an ounce or quarter of an ounce. So let me just read from Investopedia. A troy ounce is a unit of measure used for weighing precious metals that dates back to the Middle Ages, originally used in troy, Troyes, France. One troy ounce is equal to 31.1034. 768 grams, according to the UK Royal Mint. So it's just a standard size, and percentages of that are how you would refer to different amounts or coins. A digital gold currency can be, in theory, could be very useful, but if it is introduced as the main currency, you're going to end up in a severe deflation, and the bad guys are going to win. So again, there's no such thing as good or bad. It's how these things are used. I don't know. Any thoughts, Carolyn?
My thought is that we keep hearing about all sorts of remedies for alleged fraud, and the fraud that is completely overshadowing our whole society isn't the fraud that they're trying to get rid of. You know, I tried to pay cash at a food court, and they don't take cash, and supposedly it's because of counterfeit money, and it's just like I just don't believe it.
Counterfeiting is a problem. I mean, it really is a problem. The reason that state is doing gold is under the Constitution, states can issue, can use gold. And I think part of it, this is constitutional. Okay, no questions in where to stash your cash and coin. Let's turn to geopolitics and financial markets. And the first question, Carolyn, is yours.
Yes, hello. I've heard Catherine reference a phenomenon known as the Rape of Russia a few times on various money and markets shows. My search queries of the origin of the term have come up dry on the internet. Gee, you should have gone to our search engine. I assume that it is Ann Williamson who coined the term. Yes. Well, did we coin the term or did Ann
No,
Williamson?
Ann coined the term.
Okay. And she is someone who's written a good deal about this and testified. And we have four or five relevant links that we're putting in here, but it has to do with when the Soviet Union fell and became Russia again. And the Westerners, led, as far as I remember, by the United States and certain people from a certain large and prestigious educational institution in the United States, went in and set up a new system whereby a whole bunch of oligarchs got most of the spoils. Is that a fair description of what happened, Catherine?
Yeah, and the estimate is that 25 million people died from the shock. The economic shock caused the death, significant depopulation. So what happened was people's pension funds and bank accounts were emptied out and disappeared. And so they woke up and, their savings and life savings was gone, their pension funds were gone, their jobs were gone, and they had to I think it was Anne who quoted one attorney who was growing her own garden so she could eat, said, we're being demodernized. It was clearly led by the American investment banks, the American law firms, the American intelligence agencies, working intimately with the Russian mafia.
And
And
as I recall, a certain educational institution or derivative thereof.
And in fact, at the Dylan Reed book, in the links in the research section, we have the qui tam that was filed against Harvard for their role. And it was Jeffrey Sachs in the lead for one of the Harvard sort of little groups who had a contract to be the financial advisor to privatize all their assets. There's a great book called Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein, and I sent you the link for our very quick book review we did once upon a time. But if you
And
don't
that's in the
understand, if you don't understand how this kind of shock doctrine works, you basically go into a place, you abrogate all the contracts, you leave everybody high and dry. That causes assets and people to collapse, and then you pick up, you buy everything up at a song. And it's they did it in Latin America in the 90s or the late 90s, early, 2000s. They did it in Russia. All over the world, the thing I wrote on the original post, Financial Coup, I tell the story of being in London in 2001, and John Laughlin was giving presentations on the privatization in Eastern Europe, and Anne Williamson was giving a presentation on the rape of Russia. She'd been gone to Moscow as a reporter for Wall Street Journal and then left and covered it for a variety of different periodicals. But anyway, so Anne was talking about it, and then I was talking about the US. And what we realized was it was the same game globally. It was the same law firms. It was the Harvard Endowment. It was the same law firms, the same investment banks, and the same players. And they were doing it everywhere, all around the world. And
And
it was
Jeffrey Sachs's most recent incarnation has something to do with the COVID-19 crisis.
right. And so my question with Jeffrey is, since he's doing so well, maybe some of the families he helped to genocide could use some restitution. I don't normally have hard feelings for people, but if you look at how many people died, I have very hard feelings for Jeffrey Sachs. It is possible to kill with a pen.
Yes, and he seems to have come out just fine after doing that.
I think the issue is, when will we start to hold ourselves and each other accountable for these astonishing things?
Well, the first step is not to bring in the same guys who did the last one, supposedly to fix the next one.
Well, if you look at how much Sachs has turned up in having pronouncements about the future of America, pretty scary. I've told this story many times, and I tell it in my interview with Harry Blaser on Bitcoin. You had a candidate running for president on the Libertarian ticket, and he got up at the Aspen Institute and said, "Okay, here's my platform. I'm going to win, then I'm going to shut down the US government, and then I'm going to auction off all the assets, and then give everybody some Bitcoin as their universal basic income." Now, of course, Bitcoin is not a fiat currency, so it's deflationary. It's limited in amount. What that means is, you would immediately shut down 50% of the income in every county in America. And, within the next 6 weeks, that would roll off into shutting down all the retail and other industry that feeds off of that 50%. And essentially, for most people, they have a couple weeks worth of savings. They have a couple weeks worth of food. They have a couple weeks of, going without food. And then in 10 to 12 weeks, you start into a serious die-off. And he thought that was a great idea, because then Goldman Sachs who's full of cash and certain, you know, anybody who's been the beneficiary of central banking largesse is sitting on mounds and mounds of cash. That's what all these whale deposits are about. So if you shut down the whole economy and then people just start starving, then the guys with cash can go in and buy everything in pennies in the dollar. And that's exactly what happened in Russia. And if you look at what this guy at the Aspen Institute was proposing, libertarian candidate, it was the same thing. That's when I hear all these proposals about Bitcoin. People need to think about, okay, what happens if we shut down most of the income in a country and then proceed to use a scarce crypto with which the founders have huge positions, so they'll make a fortune. They'll have windfall profits and enough windfall profits to buy everything.
Right.
You know, this is not a populist proposal.
Right.
This is a proposal to help the top guys take everything.
Right.
So do not, never think it is a reform to throw an economy into a serious deflation or a shock. And, you know, what's proved again and again and again is this is always done to transfer the assets, the land, the real estate. And it's not just that you get lower prices, things that would never be for sale suddenly go on sale. Families selling businesses that they would never have dreamed of selling, but they're desperate.
Well, and I'm assuming that anytime you wipe out a whole currency or a whole system to start a new one, the people at the bottom of the old one are not going to come out better.
Well, what I said to somebody the other day was there are 156 million voters in America. 99 to 100% of them have direct or indirect investments in dollar assets, you know, T-bills, treasuries, whether through their bank or through their retirement account or their pension fund. And, you know, maybe 25 million people are invested in Bitcoin. So you're going to do something to harm 156 million to advantage 25 million. How is that a populist proposal? The dollar assets are not something that's just sitting in Wall Street or Washington.
Right.
You know, they're the assets of the man and woman on the street.
Right.
Anyway, the whole thing is quite extraordinary, but beware shock doctrine, because every time I turn around, I'm seeing somebody else propose a shock doctrine scenario as if it's some kind of fashionable or groovy. Okay, no questions in banking, other investments, retirement. I have a 401k and I'm considering rollover into an annuity for more diversification. Okay, so then they describe their situation further. So let me say this. I've never met an annuity that I liked. But there are very rare reasons why you might want to do an annuity. But if you, I always preferred when I was an investment advisor to come up with a bond portfolio where I controlled. So you go to somebody who specializes in bonds, you put together a bond portfolio, it gives you the same or a better yield than the, you know, annuity, usually with less fees, and you just manage it yourself. And if for any reason you need to liquidate it, you can with no penalty or problem because, you know, it's yours, you control. So I would rather put together sort of a guaranteed return locked in with very high quality fixed income than doing an annuity. Now, for a variety of reasons, you might prefer an annuity. You don't want to be bothered with a bond portfolio or thinking about it or whatever. I would only do an annuity with a AAA company. There are insurance companies that do annuities that have AAA from Moody's and AAA from Fitch and AA plus from S&P. So I wouldn't touch anything unless it was AAA, because I would much rather have, you know, bonds I control than be locked into an insurance company that is deteriorating in creditworthiness. So one, I would get a AAA. The second thing is, you know, you will be shown annuities that will price much better if it's a lower credit rating, but don't trust it. So that's your choice, is a very high credit rating, see what it offers you. But if you're willing to go to the challenge of doing it, putting together a very high quality bond portfolio that you control is also an alternative. Now, you can obviously do equities, and that's going to protect you more on the, you know, in certain kind of scenarios. So you can blend it if you want to. But right now, bonds are giving you, you can get very attractive yields on a high quality bond. And that's a unique circumstance. So you might want to take advantage of that. You just want to make sure it's a bond. Not only does it have a good credit rating, but it's a bond in a company that's going to be around in 15 years. Any thoughts, Carolyn?
Yeah, I actually was involved in some annuities with settlements of legal cases where, for example, there was a child beneficiary in a wrongful death suit, and the court wanted to find something where the money would be put away and it would be safe and the child would get the return according to what the court said. And an annuity vehicle is something that makes sense in that context, but you're always going to pay something in the form of a lower return if you're doing it through an insurance company or somebody else who's structuring it.
Right. Right. And there, another reason to do this is if you've got somebody who's disabled and can't, you know, can't cope with the finances, or there were reasons to do Swiss annuities because you wanted something in another jurisdiction. And
but if there's any chance you're going to want to get the money out before the annuity provides, you take a huge penalty.
Right. That's why I would always build my own portfolio. I mean, why not just ladder up your own fixed income portfolio and not worry about it?
You know, when I was young, I would have thought that I would know what happened in the future and know that I could put money away and I wouldn't need it. And I've had a 401 or IRA 401k, and life didn't happen the way I expected it. And I had to liquidate it early and I paid a 20% penalty. So what can I say?
Right. Okay, so question number four, please explain cryptocurrency. So it's a little bit like, please explain the mountains and the oceans. Okay, so where do they fit into wealth preservation? They don't. Cryptocurrencies are digital, I don't want to call them money, but digital something. They're created out of thin air. They have no income producing thing behind them. You know, the game is, can you get enough people to adopt them so they'll get vested in them? And that's where your value comes in, particularly if certain parties decide to use them for pump and dump or money laundering. So the question is, can you get the whole system to go? So I would describe it as both a speculation and a political asset, because these are, if you look at the politics and what's happening with all things digital, any cryptocurrency could go to zero tomorrow. It's just the nature of the politics on this thing. And so where does speculation fitting into wealth preservation? In my experience, if you know how to speculate, and it's really an art and requires, you know, knowledge and experience and sort of knowing how it works, speculation fits into wealth preservation, you know, on the theory that if I speculate, I can make a lot of money and then add that to my base. Part of the problem with that theory is a lot of times people get involved in the speculation and they don't get out when they don't get out during the pump. They, you know, they get stuck in the dump. Anyway, so if you think speculation is a belongs in your wealth preservation strategy, that's how it fits in. Do they fit in an overall investment strategy? One of the questions is, do you want to spend a lot of time learning about them and dealing with them? It's like anything, gold, silver, real estate. You don't want to put money into something that you don't get the intellectual mastery you need to succeed at it. So question is, do you want to invest the time? How to best invest in them? There are two ways. Well, there are a couple ways to invest in them. One is you can invest in a fund or vehicle that invests in them and they take care of all the custodian and other things in exchange for fees. Or you can buy them and leave them on an exchange, which is relatively insecure. Or you can learn how to do a wallet and buy and put them in a very secure place where they can't get hacked or stolen. Again, the question is, which one are you willing to take the time to figure out and do? I think there are real custodian issues here and complexity on the custodian issues and insecurity in the custodian issues, which is one of the reasons if you don't want to learn a lot about this and take the custodian risks, you might want to use one of the funds or ETFs. I don't know if any of the ETFs have launched yet. They're working on them. How risky are they? They're very risky. The political situation is such that any one of these things could go to zero tomorrow. Your opinion of cryptos. So I avoid cryptos. And the reason I avoid cryptos is because, well, there are several reasons, but one of them is I need all my money to invest in things that are real. If you look at the opportunities I have to invest in real people, real land, real businesses, real things happening in the real world, I need all my resources for that. And so the other thing is I'm exceptionally concerned about the political risks on crypto, and I'm exceptionally concerned about how cryptos might be used to engineer us into the end of financial transaction freedom. So I'm doing everything I can to encourage people to walk back the digital side of the financial system and do analog things. Now, if I was a salesman and I was trying to talk you into buying crypto, you know, what I'd do is I'd focus you on Bitcoin, since it's the most mature of all of them and has the best chance of sort of making it through the gauntlet if anyone does. And so, you know, what I would say is, look, you know, shock doctrine is going to happen. They're going to throw the economy into a deflation. The country's going to come apart, and Bitcoin will hold value in a way that other things won't. And, you know, that would be my pitch. And you can walk it across the border and keep it secretly. At the end of the day, if you look at where they're going, they'll have complete control. So I think I don't buy that. But if I were a salesman, that's how I would try and sell it to you. And so the question is, you know, are you worried about the shock doctrine scenarios? And do you think you'd be better off with, you know, some good land, water, and food, or, you know, with some Bitcoin in your wallet? Presumably the electricity works, but if you look at the rape of Russia, it didn't. So I don't know, Carolyn, anything to add?
Well, my observation is that I have a theory that a lot of people invest in crypto so they have something to talk about at cocktail parties. if you don't want to feel left out and you want to put a couple hundred dollars in, I don't know what the minimum is. I have no cryptos. Sure, go ahead and do it and watch what it does. But I just think it's a craze. And some people mistakenly think they can hide assets that way. And I don't think that's realistic. You know, I've just seen a whole lot of things come and go. I'm of an age where I've seen different crazes. And I think that I agree with you completely that it can be used to achieve some ends that are pretty horrible. So
you and I spent many years proving that we didn't have the offshore accounts they probably said we had. So,
right.
You know, so I've had people falsify fake financial accounts. And, you know, if you look at the speed and ease with which they could do it with cryptos, it's pretty terrifying.
Well, the complexity in figuring out capital gains and keeping up with the accounting and all of and the keys and all of that. There are just so many things that could go wrong,
right?
And that you could not understand.
Well, that's the advantage of doing it through your brokerage account. You know, you avoid a lot of those troubles. One thing I would say is before you buy crypto, particularly if you're in Australia or the Commonwealth countries, do not buy crypto unless your accountant and CPA is willing to do the documentation, include it in the taxes. Because I've known some CPAs who refuse to take clients who are trading cryptos. So just make sure your CPA is ready for this.
And understand that your net income, your net profit will go down by the amount of extra money you pay in order to find people to advise you on that.
Right.
And taxes and all of that.
Right. Okay. No questions on equity over you. Feedback. The next one is yours.
Okay. This person is a little sheepish about doing it, but decided to do it anyway because she wanted to give us a testimonial. So she's written something that says, Solaria is like a prism. And there's a photograph of a prism. Lots in life is tied to money, but Solaria shines bright beyond financial expertise in a very exhilarating and sometimes life-saving way. So thank you for that from a loyal subscriber.
And this is a high compliment. This is a subscriber who's brilliant and has sent unbelievable insight and intelligence over the years. I've learned a tremendous amount from them. So they're an extraordinary person. Okay. Comment, Yellow Freight, listening to your cast with Titus. Yellow was a customer of mine during the late 70s and 80s. Trucking was deregulated in the late 70s and the union firms were never able to shake. The union, which wouldn't acknowledge the business model, wasn't going to be competitive against non-union competition. It's amazing they hung on as long as they did. These firms couldn't pay their bills in the 80s. The unions were allowed to continue to cannibalize these firms until there wasn't anything left of them standing. Yellow is just the last to go. No surprise. You either kill the parasites or they kill you. Wow. Great insight. There's, you know, definitely
so much. There is so much that can be learned from people who remember things that happened way back, because things, so much has changed, and but there's still so much we can learn from the past.
Somebody sent in what looks like a great interview with the Corbett Report, The Truth About Oppenheimer, with Patrick McFarlane. But he's got all these quotes on war that are fabulous. So I'm just going to read them. How many Nagasaki nuclear bombs equal the radiation loosed in the 2003 Iraq War? Answer, about 250,000. Jesus. Then Heather Malik, we don't learn from war, we repeat it. We don't prevent war, we perfect it. Solzhenitsyn writes, a state of war only serves as an excuse for domestic tyranny. James Madison, if tyranny and oppression come to this land, it will be in the guise of fighting a foreign enemy. Bertrand Russell, patriotism is the willingness to kill and be killed for trivial reasons. John H. Hyland, mayor of New York, 1918 to 1925. The real menace of our republic is the invisible government, which like a giant octopus sprawls its slimy legs over our city, states, and nation. Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, the real rulers in Washington are invisible and exercise power from behind the scenes. Just for the record, America has been at war 90% of its existence, 220 years out of 247 years. We have over 700 known military bases worldwide. And then, of course, the great quote from Smedley Butler. You want to read that one, Carolyn?
Smedley Butler, 1931. War is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to be, what it seems to the majority of the people. Only a small inside group knows what it is about. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few at the expense of the very many. Out of war, a few people make huge fortunes. That is so true.
Yeah, Butler was the Marine group of the elite, tried to talk him into doing a coup, and he wouldn't do it. He outed them. Good for him. Okay, Mr. Global, no questions. Now we go to health, food, and the great poisoning. And the first question, Carolyn, is yours.
Yes, I picked this one because I have an ion cleanse machine, compliments of Catherine. And Catherine has had them too, of course. The question, Catherine has talked about it a number of times, and this person wants to know what it is and whether the one that Catherine was talking about is a major difference. And the answer is yes, that is the one that we've used. It is you get a tub of water and fill it to a particular level and put in a contraption that rests against the side of the tub, and you turn it on, and it measures the ionic, the pH of the water, and tells you to put in some salt, and then there's you find out when it's optimized, and you put your feet in it, and what happens is the difference in pHs pulls toxins out of your feet into the water. And it takes about a half an hour. And depending, there's a sort of a guide that says what the different colors of water indicate. I have found little specks of black in my water, and that presumably is heavy metals that it's pulling out of my body. Some people criticize it and say, well, your water would turn the color, which my color is a coffee, sort of a reddish coffee color. And you can put regular water in and turn it on and see what it does. And it's a lighter shade of what you're going to get. But clearly it's a different color. And I haven't had lots of things that other people probably do to see all of the different colors it might be, but definitely what is in the water when I'm finished is more than it would be if it were just plain water. So, you know, there's some contrast. Some people don't buy it, but I thought it was interesting that I've been doing saunas. And when I went for a couple of weeks without going to the gym, I found more black specks in my ion cleanse water. So, you know,
that doesn't surprise me.
I can't prove anything, but that leads me to believe that, and I do know that sweating is a way to get toxins out of your body. But this is another way. And I personally think it's a good idea to try all sorts of different ways of getting toxins out of your body. Particularly aluminum, which I'm interested in because I've just read a book on that subject, which we'll be publishing a book review on that. But aluminum to me, and of course mercury, and there are other heavy metals, are the really big ones that are good to get out of your body.
I've been using an ion cleanse machine since 2005, and I find it as a part of a detox strategy to be very helpful. You know, when I get, so if I do a long car drive, for example, I come home and do an ion cleanse machine, what comes out but all the color of the, you know, sort of the road fumes. It's all gray, black. A lot of cancers are very much associated with parasites and toxicity. And if you look at the work of Hilda Clark, she talks a lot about parasites and how to detox. One of the books I would read if I was grappling with cancer is Suzanne Summers' Bombshell. So some doctor was trying to talk her into believing she had cancer, which she didn't. But she said, you know, the reason I couldn't be bullied was because I knew about a lot of the doctors who were curing cancer naturally, like Dr. Gonzalez. And she runs around and interviews them all. And then she took that book, got on the bestseller list, and went to the mainstream, you know, morning shows and held her own. It was quite amazing. Anyway, it was a very interesting book. And Dr. Gonzalez is no longer alive, but his colleagues have kept his foundation and protocols going. So there are a lot of great people described in that book. Nothing in Energy and Environment or Tech Corner, that's next week. Or I'm sorry, it's not next week, it's the week after. So Bizarro World, the next one to you, Carolyn.
Okay, it says, I am originally from Hawaii. I am just shocked at the devastation on Maui. It seems almost impossible that an entire town was destroyed despite the high winds fueling it. Anyone that is from Hawaii knows that every single month, at the beginning of the month, a large siren goes off to test our emergency system, which warns us of natural disasters such as tsunamis and hurricanes. This system was not activated as this fire was getting out of control, but instead, with almost no notice, people's cell phones were sent a message saying to evacuate. Why would they not use the emergency siren that we were trained on every single month of our lives? Something seems a little fishy to me about this fire, and it worries me that there are all these fires all over the place. This one has taken many lives, and it almost just seems impossible that every structure in this famous town has burned down. So,
John and I covered this on Money and Markets. So clearly this looks to me very much like what happened in Paradise, California in 2017. This looks like the Paradise fires.
Yes, and I think it's really helpful to have people who have some knowledge of what it's supposed to be like, what the usual is in the place, to say, you know, you really believe them when they say this is not normal.
Right. There were so many things that were not normal. We I had a tremendous amount of people on the ground sending stories of what was happening in California, in Northern California in 2017. But we've had a lot of people sending reports from either Maui or close friends on Maui that they trust. And we published one of them and discussed it in Money and Markets. So you might want to listen to that. Okay, the next question we haven't published, but it's somebody from who is a targeted individual and concerned about their safety. And what I need to say about this, I don't want to publish it for reasons of safety. If you're in a situation like this, you have to disconnect and leave. So they're in a, what I would describe as a group that considers itself a spiritual group. Some people would call it a cult. And you just need to leave. And that's it. There's nothing to be gained by staying. You've got to get out. So, and it's up to you to disconnect, not just disconnect physically and leave, but disconnect energetically. So anyway, we will have you in our prayers. There's also a website that Richard Lightfoot runs called Targeted Justice, and you might want to check out. It's a lot of information, sort of tools on how to protect yourself there. Okay, Carolyn, recommended links is yours.
Okay. The first one I just thought was fascinating, and so I decided to talk about it. This has to do with a video about Chartres Cathedral. And this person says, a while ago, I listened to your report about Chartres that spurred me on to learn more. And I found and downloaded this video, which discusses the concept of sacred geometry as it applies to Chartres. This video has been long on my to watch list, but I finally watched it. It's fascinating. At time 34, they show parallels between the facade of the cathedral and the Hindu chakras. I found this to be more than a simple coincidence. So it was fascinating, and it had part of it has to do with what I assume is what numerology means, which has, sacred numbers and in the Hindu religion, and specific, what appears to be specific references to Hindu stories. And I just found it fascinating, partially probably because I was a history of art major and I've actually been to Chartres, but anyway, that's fascinating, and I recommend it to your attention. The second one is about craft beer. I live in Cincinnati, and beer is a huge deal here. There are all sorts of beer breweries. I don't know whether that's true in every city, but we've got dozens of them. And this is talking about gene-edited yeast is taking over craft beer. Apparently, some people who were interested in producing beer and were in STEM classes started through their chemical and biological learnings in school to explore ways to change the taste of beer. And they say that hops are one of the most expensive parts of making beer. So if one could find a way to change the flavor of beer so that you didn't need hops, that would be a way to save money. So apparently they used CRISPR technology and inserted genes from things like plants with flavor, for example, mint, to customize the taste of beers. Now, I've never liked beer. I don't drink at all now. And I thought beer was the most foul tasting thing I'd ever tasted anyway. So I don't believe that you can do much with it by inserting mint. But anyway, the idea of inserting genes into beer is just shows you where we're going.
So Pharma Food is going to the printer next week. I can't wait for everybody to read it. It's been up on the web since January, but still, it's quite amazing. And if you look at what these guys are doing, I mean, why make a hamburger for X dollars when you can make it for 5X with a 3D printing machine? It's so, you just can't imagine what they think they're going to be able to sell as food.
The next one is from Scott Ritter's channel, and it's about a fellow named Gonzalo Lira, who was a Chilean American married to a Ukrainian and apparently living in the Ukraine. He was a former lifestyle coach turned commentator on the internet, geopolitical commentator, in the lead up to the Russian invasion of the Ukraine, saying presumably controversial things. And he was arrested and then let go, and arrested and then let go by the SBU and information operations in the Ukraine. And the person who's posted this suggests, you know, he asks, gee, why would they arrest him and then let him go and continue to do the things that he was doing before he was arrested and then arrest him again and let him go? Gee, maybe he's turned informant. But that aside, our poster, our subscriber says, the idea the West is transforming into a Soviet-style computerist community with one-dimensional thinking is frightening. This means all the weed that is stubbornly thinking differently needs to go. And I will read, it says, bluntly stated, if you are a U.S. citizen who holds a position counter to the official U.S. government Ukrainian narrative regarding the Russian-Ukrainian conflict, you are being treated as a hostile combatant in the information war that has sprung up around this conflict, regardless of your constitutionally protected right to free speech. And if you are not an American, you're free game. Just in case that point isn't driven home strong enough, consider the following. The CCD, with the backing of the United States, has published a blacklist of persons, including many notable American citizens, of persons it has labeled information terrorists. According to the CCD, its mission, carried out in conjunction with Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council, is twofold. First, to combat information terrorism, and second, to coordinate this effort with international quote-unquote partners. So,
well, we're seeing moves for censorship everywhere. So, yes. And that's why this Missouri versus Biden litigation is so interesting. I just read coverage of the appeals. You watched the appeals court hearing, right?
Yes.
And it looks to me like the state, the Missouri people made a much better case than the Department of Justice.
Oh, the attorney. This is Missouri v. Biden. And they had an attorney who used to be with government. He was a government attorney. And I think maybe the Department of Justice. He's an excellent attorney. But the attorney who spoke from the either Missouri or Louisiana AG's office, I guess it was, or U.S. attorney, probably U.S. attorney, that person was excellent also. The fellow who was representing the Department of Justice really, really didn't do a good, I mean, he was just so outgunned. It was disgusting. I mean.
Well, so Missouri was represented by an ex-DOJ guy?
Yeah, I think.
And was Louisiana represented or just behind the Missouri attorney?
I don't, actually, you're probably right that they were two different. They were speaking on behalf of two different plaintiffs, but I didn't really try to understand that distinction.
Right, but there were two attorneys speaking for the state AGs, right?
Yes.
And then one speaking for DOJ.
Yes.
And DOJ was totally outgunned.
Totally outgunned, and you could tell from the questions from the court, from the panel. It was actually a panel of the court, because you have panels of judges when you go to the district court or the middle level court, federal court. And you could tell that they were pretty sympathetic to the plaintiff's case. I thought, we shall see.
We shall see. Okay.
I think this is on a fast track. So I think that we should be hearing something before too long. I don't think it'll be like 2 years the way two or five or 10 years the way we went through when we were at Hamilton waiting for judicial opinions from the federal court. The next one is a Twitter post from a speech given presumably before, I guess it's parliament that they call it in Australia, a senator who we've seen before. And he is exposing, this is in Australia, exposing the military involvement, U.S. military involvement in the COVID jab caper, if you will excuse that expression on my part. But our subscriber says, Catherine Watt details how it's all a military program with WHO, Australia connected to the USA. Clearly, it's a, the perpetration of the countermeasures, which are sometimes called vaccines for COVID, the alleged pathogen COVID-19, were an internationally coordinated effort led by either the Department of Defense or higher up, meaning CIA, NSA types. And it's what I thought was interesting is that the Australians, at least some of them, are pretty have picked up the exposés that some of the people in the United States have put out. And I'm also including it here. Sasha Latapova's coverage is excellent on this point, and she's done lots of interviews. And so she's at Bailiwick News at Stubstack.com, which I put a link to in here. But this fellow is fairly entertaining. It's kind of interesting to see.
It's Malcolm Roberts from Australia. He's very good.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think he's been here over the week, and we've run his videos several times. He's quite eloquent, and he's got them nailed.
We have three links related to the Maui fires or subjects inspired by the Maui fires. One of them has to do with the U.S. military exposed wildfires as a weapon, in which they talk about the military being involved with the Forest Service in learning how to burn fires, forest fires better.
Yeah, that's staying at Stan Wigington, getting some of the old documents of, you know, for the military of how to engineer a forest fire and as an act of war, but make it look like it's natural.
Right. And then this one I included just because of its fond memories of Catherine and me dealing with HUD some 25 years ago. And this is from justthenews.com. And it's the headline is HUD averages $232,000 cost for each affordable housing unit it creates. And I distinctly remember, now Catherine was prohibited from by our contract with FHA or HUD from going into the building at HUD because she had been a Republican appointee and we were working for a Democratic administration. At least that was that was the most obvious reason. So in some instances, I was sent in order to get Catherine's message across to the appointees at HUD. And I was instructed to question the investment of $200,000 per unit in apartment, you know, rehabbing existing apartments or even building them at $200,000 per apartment unit when HUD owned housing stock that was valued at $50,000 that the same people could have lived in. And so I would go to these meetings with the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Housing and then say, well, so how much is HUD willing to invest in single units of apartment buildings? Is $200,000 too much when HUD owns $50,000 units?
Yeah, so actually it was, as the, you know, for the Hope 6 program was 250.
Okay, so, well, you remember the number.
Yeah, so when I saw the 232, I thought, oh, they brought the price down. So I mean, but why get a housing unit for 50 or 100,000 when you can spend 200 or 250, right?
Absolutely.
Right. Absolutely. It's like the 600. It's the housing equivalent of the $600 hammer.
Right. And I would come back to the office and find out that they had called you
and complained.
To complain, and you said, oh, I'll talk to Carolyn. And when I returned, she'd say, good job, Carolyn. I was a hatchet man. The next one is Maine hospital that fired workers for refusing the jab asks them to come back. This is an article from Children's Health Defender. And I mean, this is just, It's just sickening. And they particularly focus on one particular nurse who had worked for the main hospital system for, call it, 30 years and was fired for not taking the jab. And apparently she and a bunch of other people that they had talked to, nurses had from the system, had gotten texts asking them if they want to come back. Can you imagine getting an offer to come back when you've been fired? And some or all of these people were turned down for unemployment benefits, and some of them disciplined. So they had bad things in their record for, you know, failing to follow orders that would follow their records into the future. And, you know, they get a text saying, "You want to come back to work?" 2 years. So it's still out there. The next one is Michigan AG admits 8,000 to 10,000 fake ballots were turned in. She covered it up. And this has to do with the 2020 election. I just selected this, and probably our subscribers submitted it, because it's still a live issue of the issue of fake ballots and whether the 2020 election was rigged. And this is from Gateway Pundit, and clearly the Michigan AG redacted police report describes how Muskegon County City Clerk Meisch, that's the name, encountered a woman dropping off 8,000 to 10,000 completed voter registration applications. The Gateway Pundit reported that the registrations included the same handwriting, non-existent addresses, and incorrect phone numbers. So the Michigan AG admitted this after Gateway Pundit found the police and published the police report. It wasn't just 8,000 to 10,000 ballots, probably. The next one is, I enjoy it when our subscribers bring links to old publications that either predict what's actually happening now or show that something has been an issue for many years and presumably called out or attempted to be called out by people many years ago. And this one is a book called The Poisoned Needle, which was written in 1957. This is a bit shoot. Someone actually went through and took pictures of each page, because it's a book that you can't really get easily. So if you're interested in this, you should go read it on BitChute quickly. And it has to do with a TB test. And the person who posted this said, "I read this book many years ago when I was researching the TB test or shot that my employer was forcing us to take. The nurse and doctor at my employer said it's just a test. Wrong. I learned that phenol was one of the main ingredients in the Manitou TB test that the fraud Louis Pasteur invented. They inject poison under your skin, usually on the back of your hand or on your arm somewhere. After a couple of days, if you don't react to the poison, you don't have TB. Phenol is a highly toxic substance, and I tried going to management and my union to tell them how bad the TB tests were. None of them cared or listened to me. My boss even said, 'Trust the science,' to me once. LOL. I found out I could get a particular blood test to determine if I had TB or not to give my employer, but I had to pay for it out of my own pocket, $120 Canadian for each test. They wanted us to get a TB test every few years. Then they wanted it every year. And then I heard they wanted it done 4 times a year, and I knew there was something wrong here. There was a TB epidemic happening? No. These toxic substances in vaccines and TB tests accumulate in our bodies, and eventually they will make us sick or even kill us. I said I would gladly pay for the blood test so I wouldn't be poisoned over time. Also, my employer wanted to force me to take the yearly flu shot, but thankfully the ambulance worker union said no to that and made it our choice or not."
Fabulous.
I love
these. Very lucky. Yeah.
I love these anecdotes. Yep. You know, you just know people don't make this stuff up.
Right. The best, that's why the more we can circulate with each other, the smarter we get.
Right. You get similar stories coming from different parts of the world. How could it be, right. You know, made up? Next one is Canada passes a far-reaching internet censorship law. It's from granitegrok.com. C11, which I guess is the designation of the bill, has given the government the ability to regulate user content on social media. It has given itself the ability to censor content that it doesn't like. But more importantly, it has given itself the ability to control every aspect of your online experience. We are potentially moving from the open and rambunctious World Wide Web to a controlled online experience where we can access what the government allows us to access.
You know, the efforts to censor is coming down all across the EU. It's coming down in Canada and the Commonwealth countries. And this is why Missouri and Biden is so important. They're trying to do it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of other, there's an Aptor, a case that Dr. Malik is involved in, that's a free speech issue on behalf of doctors, and that should be able to speak out and say what they think about various medical products and so-called pathogens. So that one is important also. The next one is Biden wants to build housing for illegal immigrants on the border. This is from the Gateway Pundit. And I would point out that there was an interview that RFK Jr. did talking, and also a mini documentary about his trip to the border and spending all night and 3 days, I guess, at the border and seeing the illegal immigration that was occurring. And it's very different from what we imagine, but the numbers of people that they're talking about, they're just thousands of people streaming into the U.S. And there have been, he reported, and it's reported elsewhere, that there have been proposals to put, 95,000 people in Central Park?
Yes, can you imagine?
Migrants? Are these tent cities? Or, really?
It's going to be, Central Park will be turned into a tent city.
Of people from Ghana and China?
Yep.
I mean, we're not even talking people from south of the border particularly.
Right.
They're from all over the world, and they fly through Mexico. Well, one popular route is through Mexico City. They fly into Mexico City and they get instructions as to exactly what the U.S. law is and what will happen. So they know exactly what will happen.
Right. It's a huge business.
Yes.
Bringing these people in.
I'll leave it to you to speculate why someone would want that. The other thing
we just brought it back and blasted the past. We have a wonderful Salir report in the archives on the weaponization of migration. And we just brought it back as blast in the past.
And Robert Kennedy points out absolutely accurately that many of us who were progressives way back when and had, you know, thought this was something that was good for people, poor people who had nowhere else to go and, you know, were persecuted. And what he says and what everything I've seen lately indicates, this is a cruel thing, and it is not for the benefit of anyone.
Right. So it's Professor Kelly Greenhill, Weapons of Mass Migration. And we just had it
human
again.
Trafficking involved.
Yeah, there's definitely, because there's almost 100,000 children that have disappeared. The children are called out.
Women being raped to pay for their passage, people using their entire life savings for this, or bringing the rest of their life savings with them and being robbed by the people who are facilitating this.
Right.
It's just not humanitarian. The next one, I am such a gullible person. I read this and I thought, what? And found out from Catherine, I guess, that I fell for it, but that John Rappaport enjoys making a joke out of something that is not funny. And this involves what apparently Gavin Newsom did was he makes up a scenario where he says Gavin Newsom, who's the president or the governor of California, is defending his policy of permitting violent male prisoners who identify as women to be transferred to women's prisons in California. And he makes up this speech by Gavin Newsom, where Gavin Newsom says he's an AI program by Disney Corporation, to highlight how ridiculous this all is, and that perhaps stress that no human being could come up with a plan like this. It's amusing, but sad too.
Yep.
Okay, that does it for recommended links.
Okay, so then we have Take Action and Local Gatherings and No Questions. So that's it for this week. It's a bit of a short week, Carolyn. Only 45 items. Yeah. Okay. So
can I just say that we had several things because of how we do this. We, you know, a week may elapse between the time we deal with a particular Ask Catherine question and when we actually record. And then it's a couple more days before it is actually posted. And if you put in something in Ask Catherine that has to do with needing help on something, or wanting to make a comment about the website, possible change, that is not something that we would be doing in Ask Catherine. That's something that would go to the technical people. So if that's what you want any kind of prompt action on it or action to that we don't have to send back and forth, you'll post that. You'll actually do a support ticket on the site rather than posting it in Ask Catherine.
Right. So when you go to the website, you want to click on support right in the navigation bar on the upper right of the page. Just click on support and fill out a support ticket, and you'll get something much, much faster.
Well, that's very prompt process.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on Ask Catherine and the Solari team. Carolyn and I will be back next week. And again, thank you for your questions. Keep them coming. And if you have comments on any of the things you posted, this will be in the commentary on Friday, and feel free to jump in and comment right there. Okay. Carolyn, thank you once again, and I will talk to you next week.
Okay. Have a great week.